Phi Theta Kappa, we include speaker series. My name is America Perez, and I am a Phi Theta Kappan who will be graduating in May with my degree in liberal arts. I'm really excited to hear what we're going to cover today because the topics we're covering are very near and dear to my heart. So our speaker today is Demonte Stogner. He is a community engagement associate for the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. The ACLU was founded to defend and preserve the individual rights and liberties guaranteed to every person by the Constitution and the laws of the United States. Demonte will be leading a discussion about racial justice and immigration and the legal and social challenges for these populations and how we might better understand and serve these college and community constituencies. Please join me with a warm welcome for Demonte Stogner.
How are you all today? Can everybody hear me?
Yep. Just fine.
So I don't need to use a microphone then. All right. Thank you. Well, how are you all doing today? Again, I'm Demonte Stogner from the ACLU. Really excited to be here and speak with you guys today. So I'll tell you a little bit about myself and how I came here to the ACLU. I actually started out in juvenile reentry. So I was working for Polk County Detention Center for a short time. And then transitioned over to United Way of Central Iowa when we wrote the reentry grant 2 years ago for returning citizens. So I had a big part and big hand in really getting involved in the prison system and understanding a lot more about the prison system than I understood from working in it with juveniles before. So that's just a little bit of my background. I have a very strong background in criminal justice. I have a criminal justice degree from Grambling University. Where I also wrestled at as well. So just a little bit about myself. And then now I'll tell you guys a little bit about the ACLU and kind of break it into a group discussion, per se. So the ACLU was founded in 1935. We're a nonpartisan private organization. We're here to basically protect and advance the civil liberties of everyone in the state of Iowa. We work in the Iowa legislature, the federal courts, and the district courts through public education and advocacy. We work on a variety of issues: freedom of speech, racial justice, LGBTQ rights, student rights, privacy rights, open government and records, reproductive rights, religious freedoms, immigrants' rights, women's rights, criminal justice reform, voting rights, as you guys already know, HR 14. Please make sure we get that passed. And an array of other issues that the ACLU works on. So this presentation here is usually the presentation I give to an immigrants group, and so I thought this would be a good way to really challenge some of our thinking around freedom and our rights. So again, this presentation is intended to provide you with general legal information. It's not pretended. To provide you with general legal information. This is not legal advice. Everyone's case or situation is different, so please seek legal advice from an attorney if you need advice. And like I say, many legal cases have time limits, so make sure you know the time limit on your case or what you're up against to make sure that the statute of limitations cannot be provided towards your case, and then you won't be able to bring anything forward. So this is just a basic Know Your Rights presentation. So when you're interacting with law enforcement, when you're getting raided, or when the cops say they have a warrant out for your arrest, or when they come to your door with a search warrant. So the big picture goal here for you to walk away and say, I know my legal rights are, I can constructively and assertively assert those rights in a police or ICE interactions. So, this is where we start to have more of a group discussion here. So our first one right here says you have a right to remain silent. Now most, we're talking about racial justice, or we're talking about equality or inequality. We know that if you're in a neighborhood with a white officer and you're black or you're brown skin, all of a sudden you're scared. So it's hard to stay silent. One, now the officer starts asking you a lot of questions, and you feel that authoritative state over you. So how do you practice your integrity? One, how do you practice still feeling safe knowing that this authoritative figure with a gun holster is standing over you asking you all these questions? So That's one thing that always gets me. A little story I'll tell you guys. I actually used to live in Washington, Iowa, about 30 minutes south of Iowa City. When I first moved there, I didn't drive to school when I first moved there. We were from Chicago, had just moved to Iowa. My dad was working down in a Procter & Gamble in Iowa City. So most of the kids that I went to school with, I was the only black kid at the school. Most of the kids I went to school with, they were driving tractors, they were driving four-wheelers, they were driving bicycles. I mean, everybody had something to drive. Everybody was driving to school. And so I go home and I tell my dad, I'm like, man, everybody driving to school. I'm like, man, I need something to drive. Well, I didn't know, I mean, we're from Chicago. I didn't know the laws. I didn't know what I needed to know at the time. And I guess my dad didn't know what he needed to know at the time either. I told him I wanted to drive, and so they got me a car. I had an 86 Buick Regal my dad got from a salvage shop place in town. So we fixed it up, put some brakes on there, put a new carburetor deal in there, got it fixed up. I started driving back and forth to school. My third day driving to school, I get pulled over. Now, I had always thought about wrestling. This is how I got into wrestling. I had always thought about wrestling because I saw wrestling on TV, and I saw some guys that looked like myself, and these guys had muscles. I mean, they were moving. I'm like, man, I can do that. And so I had been thinking about that. Well, the wrestling coach in Washington was also a police officer. So he pulls me over. It's like, hey, you know, license registration. I'm like, I don't got a license. Like, what are you talking about? So they pull me out of the car. I get arrested. I'm a freshman. I get arrested for driving without a license. I'm like, oh my God. So they call my mom, call my dad. My dad rushes home. You know, he comes and gets me. And my dad's having work. I can't hear the words that they're having out there, but I hear my dad. He's out there yelling. I know he's heated. I didn't get any charges, but I think my dad and Officer Ellingson started to, they created a rivalry. And so my dad started letting me drive without a license. I wasn't supposed to be driving, but he said, it's fine. You know, you can drive, and everybody else driving to school, you can drive too. That cost me gravely. I had so many tickets for driving without a license. I would drive to school, hurry up and get out the car, and then run into school. And then I'd come back, and I'd have a ticket on my car, or I'd have a ticket in the mail for driving without a license. So it was just racking up. I mean, it got me in a ton of trouble. But that was one of my first instances of, I felt like being, because I didn't know you needed to have a license. No one ever told me that I needed to have a license, but every single time this guy would just get behind me and pull me over or put a ticket on my windshield, and now I got to pay all this money to actually get a license. So before I even had a license, I had to pay $4,000 to even get a license. It was ridiculous. But it really got me to the point where it led me down a path of trouble because I was tired of getting tickets, so I started to run. I ended up running one night, got myself into a lot of trouble, got charged with felony eluding because I ran and didn't stop when they put the cherries on for me. So that got me into some trouble. I ended up doing some probation time and got involved with the criminal justice system myself as well from that point. And then I got out of that. I ended up, you know, wrestling in college and doing some other things to just make sure my life was on the right path. But that was kind of my first and up close encounter with the criminal justice system. And from that, I began to, work with juveniles and other individuals and really start to try and broaden my understanding of the criminal justice system. So we're talking about you have a right to refuse a consent to a search of yourself or your phone or your car or your home, including your dorm room. Again, when I go back thinking about myself or my family in the state that we were at, if you're not educated around those things, how do you know what you can tell an officer what they can and can't do? If they're standing over you and they're telling you, hey, you know, they've already pulled you over, so that's one sign of authority that we have over you. They've already pulled me over. How can I fully assert if I don't understand, hey, you can't search my car, hey, why'd you pull me over for no reason? You just saw me and you turned around and pulled me over. Like, how can I do that? And so that's really tough for people who lack the education and knowledge around their rights, whether it be civil rights, human rights, civil liberties, whatever they may be. It's really tough to be able to assert those type of that type of knowledge when you're in a situation where it's very sticky and touchy. You have a right to a lawyer if you're arrested. You can ask for one immediately. Again, we're seeing in the news now, there are plenty of cases where people are asking for lawyers, but the cops won't give them a lawyer. We're seeing in the news where there's plenty of cases where people are being coerced and saying that they're guilty, and then come out 5 or 10 or 15 or 30 years later, oh, that guy was innocent. So when talking about racial justice, immigrants' rights, and speaking about these things, we really have to understand the historical context of our country. You know, how did we get to a place where we have to have someone going around explaining what your rights are? Why do we have to have an organization be put together to say we're going to fight for people's civil liberties? I thought we were born with civil liberties. So if we don't understand the historical context of our country and understand some of the historical past of our country, it'll be hard to move forward. It'll be hard to really understand and grasp why we have to have these type of presentations, why we have to have individuals talking about civil rights, human rights, civil liberties. So again, number 5, you have a right to not say anything about your immigration status. There's a couple of cases right now that the ACLU of Arizona is working on where cops are actually walking up to people, asking them, hey, do you have your green card? Do you have your ID, your identification card on you? And so if you don't have those things and you know you don't have them, what you take off running? I mean, people are forced into, you're almost being forced into a situation where you have to either run from the cops, you either lie to the cops, or you go to jail. So which one? Like that, and that's a really tough place to be in. Either I lie to the cops, I run from the cops and get myself in trouble, or I go to jail and risk not being around my family, not being able to take care of my family, not being able to do what I need to do. So that brings us to number 6, don't resist arrest. This is a really tough one that I have a hard time, just for me being who I am and, you know, coming from Chicago, Illinois. When I was younger, I really witnessed a lot of things that I knew were injustice, but at the time I didn't really understand the criminal justice system. And now being older, it's like, it would be hard for me. Yes, I would say, hey, don't resist arrest, but it's really hard for me to say that and to really exert that and fully believe that because of the injustices I've seen. Like, how can you pull me out of my car for no reason, or how can you just stop me walking down the street for no reason and tell me you're going to search me, or you're going to arrest me, or you're going to take me in for questioning? Like, I feel like that's a violation of my safety. And so I don't feel personally wholeheartedly saying, hey, don't resist arrest even if they are in the wrong. Now, you shouldn't resist arrest if they're in the wrong, because we see the power that the police have. They have tons of manpower. They have tons of legislative and legal power. So you're probably not going to win. So me being logical, I would say, no, do not resist arrest. But deep personal, I'm like, man, that really sucks, because some of the issues and some of the injustices people face, you're like, why didn't they run? Or why didn't they fight back? Like, at some point, when are they going to fight back? So that's one that I really have a tough time with understanding, because there's no accountability, I feel personally, on police. And then number 7, in Iowa, you do not have to tell the police who you are if you're a passenger in the vehicle, unless you're the passenger the cop pulled the vehicle over for. So if you're like in the front seat, you don't have a seatbelt on, and the cops pull over that vehicle and say, hey, I need your identification card, and you say, oh, no, I don't have. Well, you do have to, because the probable cause was you not having a seatbelt on, and they pulled the car over for that. So they can actually ask the driver and the passenger both for identification. But if you're not and you're in the back seat and the cops pull you over and they just want to know who you are, you don't have to provide that information. But again, a lot of times people are scared and don't know that they don't have to provide that information and provide it anyway. If ICE or immigration agents come to your home, you do not have to let them in unless they have certain kinds of warrants. There are three different types of warrants. There's a search warrant, there's an arrest warrant, and then there's an ICE or administrative ICE warrant. The only warrant that you can, that police can come into your house or ICE can come into your house without your permission is a warrant signed by a judge. So an ICE administrative warrant signed by a judge, an arrest warrant signed by a judge, or a search warrant signed by a judge, they can come in your house without your permission. If most times, 99% of the time, ICE only has an ICE warrant for removal with a supervisor's signature, which does not give them legal right to come into your home without your permission. So they need actual human permission from a person who lives there. If you're arrested by police on criminal charges, say you wish to remain silent and want to speak with a lawyer. Again, we're talking about racial and immigration, especially for people who don't understand the laws or how our system works. It's really tough for you to navigate a system where you don't understand how it works. You know, you go to jail and, well, you only get one phone call. Well, then after that, you have to pay money to make a phone call to your family or to the people that are helping you. Well, if you don't have any money, well, you don't understand that you need to get word to them to tell them to put money on your books so you can call home so they can help you, you're in a world of hurt. You got a $2,000 bond, you're sitting there, you can't get word out to your family who has the money, but you don't, I mean, it's a really tough situation to be in when you don't understand how the system works and you don't understand how our laws work here in Iowa or across the United States, because every different state has different laws against different things. So you really, it's tough to really navigate around every part of the state, every different law that you can and cannot break. So if you're taken into ICE custody, you have a right to a lawyer, but the government does not provide one of those for you. So again, if you're taken into custody and you're the sole provider for your family, how do I get out of there? ICE can't give me, the government can't give me a lawyer. I might not be able to get word back to my family. Now my children may be in jeopardy. Now that's costing the state more because now their kids maybe can go awry and end up in our juvenile justice system. I mean, it's a whole total pot of ramifications just from this one single incident. So that's why it's really important for people to understand and educate themselves around state laws, immigration laws, criminal justice laws. Now, before we keep going with this, does anybody have any questions so far?
How does this work with the language barrier? I mean, if you're not an English-speaking person and this happens, is a interpreter go along with whomever?
So that was one of the issues we ran into. So I previously worked at United Way of Central Iowa. We had a grant called Central Iowa Returning Citizens Achieve, where we were actually looking for immigrants and minority status individuals to bring into the program. Well, one of the problems we started running into, a lot of the Africans didn't speak English that we were bringing into the program. We had to go back and do a whole budget modification to find money to bring in an interpreter. Well, then the interpreter couldn't go into the prison because they wasn't pre-trained. So now these folks that we had already paid $8,200 for to train from DMAC in our TDL class, I mean, it was for a whole 2 months, it was just a nightmare because of a language barrier. So again, resources are very thin. So it's tough for an individual who has a language barrier that's not English to get help here.
You know, you said that they're entitled to a lawyer by law, but they're not entitled to an interpreter by law, correct?
Correct.
So I could get a lawyer, but we might not even be able to communicate because I don't speak this language.
Correct. If yesterday I did a presentation over in North High School, and one of the girls, she was a younger girl, and she asked, she said, "It seems like our prison system, our criminal justice system is swelling," she said, "but the the underlying policies of the criminal justice system is rehabilitation. She said, why do you think? She said, because obviously they're not rehabilitating. I mean, this girl was on the money. She was really good. She was good. She said, obviously they're not rehabilitating. She said, why do you think that is? Well, if you start to look at, I don't know if you guys ever heard of, all of them are called prison industries, but each state has their own. So it's like Iowa Prison Industries, Illinois Prison Industries, Minnesota Prison Industries. And then when you get down south, some of them are more private. But up here in the Midwest, they're all like named by the state: Illinois, Ohio, Nebraska Prison Industries. Well, these are all nonprofit organizations, but they make stuff like microphones, these stands, the tables, the chairs that you're sitting in. They'll come in and clean this whole entire DMAC campus, mow the grass. They work over at the governor's office. I mean, you name any type of sector, any type of job that can be performed by a human, IPI has a contract with them. So while these individuals who are under IPI's care, inmates or returning citizens, we call them, these individuals are getting paid 45, 50 cents, maybe on the dollar, while some of these contracts are for $17, $18, $19.50 an hour. So there is really, and IPI, who does IPI answer to? I don't know. Where does this money go to that these people make? Like, where does it go back to? I don't know. That's for people to research. But when you start to understand the profit margins from these entities, why would there be an incentive to rehabilitate someone? If I rehabilitate you and then you leave and then you don't come back, that means I lose a potential worker. Well, if I start losing potential workers over time, well, then there's no more need for me. Then no one needs me anymore. So I'm not saying that that's what's going on, but me looking at it personally, you have to start drawing some conclusions, like, why aren't people being rehabilitated? And why are these prison industries gaining more contracts? How do they keep getting more? How are they expanding? So those are some of the questions that I would start to ask. Do you have something?
Oh, I was just thinking, why they have these contracts is because they're charging $18. If they go private, they're going to cost them, it's going to cost $35. So they get these contracts because they're cheaper than typically
cheap labor. So is there like an incentive for cheap labor then to keep people in prison?
I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying the law of numbers says if I'm a business owner and I can hire this person cheaper, I'll go with the cheaper company. And where they get their labor, I probably don't ask questions. I just know they're
cheaper.
This contract's cheaper than this one.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's IPI.
IPI.
Yeah.
Iowa Prison
Industry.
No, they really make everything. They literally, I mean, they have contracts. I mean, they have people waking up at 3 a.m. in the prison. They leave the prison at 3 a.m. and travel all the way to Davenport, Iowa. All the way to North Liberty, Iowa, to the plastic factory, or to Kelowna, Iowa, the Kelowna cheese factory, or to Mason. I mean, you name it, Iowa Prison Industries has a contract with almost everyone. So it's hard to have an incentive to rehabilitate individuals when you get cheap. Are there any other questions?
If we see this type of injustice happening to somebody, what's the best thing that we could do as like a bystander? Say we see a police officer pull somebody over, or we're just in that situation, what can we do to help our brothers and sisters?
I mean, you see a lot of injustice now as we're like recorded. Like, a lot of people have cell phones. Again, I wouldn't personally tell you to, hey, go walk over to the officer and say, stop doing this injustice to my person, because, again, understanding how the law works and understanding how things work here in America, now you in trouble as well for just trying to help. So it sucks. It's a very tough and sticky situation, but I would say be a witness So when a person goes to court, show up to court with them. If you can, record the incident, if that's what you can do. But I would not personally tell you to get involved because, again, understanding how the system works, you're going to potentially get yourself in trouble, in legal trouble as well.
So are there people at the ACLU that you can contact and report an injustice?
Yes, so we have a website, iowaacluoutreach.org. And so you can send your case there, and then our legal team will actually review it. And then if they feel that it's broad enough to make some sweeping changes, then they'll probably reach out to you. But again, they're going to review it and just see what it is and how it can really affect some broader change. But that's what we're mostly
so
about.
Does the ACLU have resources that they can connect you with or know of people like if you feel like you've been wronged by the law enforcement agencies or by the laws, if I would reach out to the ACLU, can they connect me with people that can help me?
Yep, we'd probably tell you to either go with Iowa Legal Aid. If you were looking for like a private attorney, there's an array of different attorneys in Iowa or in Des Moines, Iowa per se. But yeah, we would probably tell you to file a complaint with Iowa Legal Aid, maybe file a complaint with the Bar Association. It just all depends on what's actually going on. But again, like if it's a legal situation, the ACLU is going to have you submit it through the outreach account, and then we're going to sit around and discuss it, see exactly what broad sweeping changes we can make if you were to win the case or if we were to bring it to light, and then we would go from there. I think that just starts with simple conversations, you know, being open to having conversations with individuals you don't normally have conversations with, being open to, I guess, sharing a little personal background story about yourself or something, so that way you can learn about another individual and kind of transfer that experience and really try and understand their experience. So that would probably be my biggest piece of advice, is really just seeking to understand and trying to understand others' perspective, trying to gain as many experiences as you can from other individuals, so that way you are more open. And that's probably going to change the ideology of our country as well, the more people do that. Just simple conversations, I would say, and just, you know, being open, listening, active listening. That's another one. That's a huge one, active listening. Listening with the intent to just listen, not having a rebuttal or response right after a person says something, but really just listening and trying to understand where they're coming from. Anyone else? There's too many crickets in a row.
What are some like specific policies or current changes that are happening?
I would say HJF 14, that's the Felon Voting Rights Bill. Right now there's an exclusion bill attached to it that's saying basically if you get out, you want your voting rights back, you have to have paid all restitution off to a victim, so to an actual human victim, not an estate victim or not an organization or agency, but an actual human victim. But again, that's still, so the example we use at the ACLU, even if it's an accident, vehicular homicide, where you don't go to prison or anything like that, automatically in Iowa, you're tacked on with $150,000 restitution you have to pay to the victim's estate. Even if it's an accident, even if you don't go to prison or go to jail or anything, it's still $150,000 you have to pay to the victims for victims restitution. Well, if you don't have the money to pay for the victim's restitution, then you can't vote. So it's basically saying if you don't have the money or the means or the resources, again, still, you can't participate in voting or electing your representation. So I would say really support HJ 214, but without the exclusion bill.
Policy or legislation or even just like some kind of movement surrounding the concern with these really predatory labor issues that you're talking about, this cheap labor of vulnerable populations. Are you hearing like any kind of speaking out against that?
Well, there is an organization out of Pennsylvania, and they actually just hired someone in Cedar Rapids to kind of grow it here in Iowa. It's called the Reform Alliance. There's a couple rap artists that actually started it. Meek Mill, he was, I guess, like under some sort of scrutiny where the judge ended up sentencing him to like 16 years probation, and he was just in and out on these frivolous charges for like doing wheelies on a bike, and I guess one time he like left outside of the county line, but it was for work, and they end up finding that these were like very frivolous charges that kept him going back and forth to prison while he was working and like trying to provide for his family. So they actually started an organization called the Reform Alliance, and they're actually gaining some pretty good traction right now throughout the country, but just bringing light to some criminal justice reform, some of the living conditions in the prison, some of the food and nutrition deficiencies that the inmates are facing, there's a lot of reform that they're bringing to the table for some change. So
I don't know where it's currently at, but there was a lot of talk about sanctuary cities a few years ago, and I know a lot of police chiefs have come out in favor of it and believe it's an effective way to help people and take care of people and keep the city safe. And has the ACLU been involved in those conversations, or is there how is it currently in Iowa?
Not at the moment. They just struck down the... There was a bill introduced that basically, and this was one thing that the ACLU was really surprised at, and they always talk about it right now. There was a bill that was introduced that would basically force police departments to racial profile, because you had to have I guess proper paperwork, and they would be able to ask you for that paperwork. Well, police officers aren't gonna walk up, like say you're a person from Germany or somewhere in Europe, they're not gonna walk up and say, hey, are you the German American? Do you have your, but if you're black or brown, hey, do you have your paperwork on you? So it would have been forcing police agencies to racially profile, in which the Sheriff's Union and like the National Police Union actually came up and said, hey, no, we want to strike this down as well, because it's going to force us to racially profile, which we don't want. But at the same time, we can't get an anti-racial profiling bill introduced. So that kind of says a little bit about where we at as a country. They don't want to, because that would put, well, if you think about it, that would put police departments on the hook to be sued. Like, there's a law in the books. You're clearly following the law, but it's a violation of my constitutional rights. Boom, that's an easy lawsuit. But having a racial profiling, an anti-racial profiling ban or bill would do the opposite. So it's again, like it's the ideology of our country. So something has to change with our ideology.
Do you see much conversation, even at the national level? I think sometimes when I think about criminal justice reform issues, I think we struggle with people coming from two different perspectives. There's the group of people that believe the criminal justice system is intended to be punitive, that somebody did something wrong and they need to be punished for it, and then there are those that view it as being reform-based. I mean, on a much smaller scale, I think of this as a high school principal. When a kid gets in trouble, some people want them to be punished, and my goal is typically to get them to not do the same thing again. Do you see that conversation still taking place at the national level where we're talking about the criminal justice system exists to punish people for being for doing something wrong, or is it really designed to help them not make the same choice again?
That's a good question. A lot of the conversation right now is around probation and parole, but particularly the criminal justice system is doing what it was designed to do. And I think that's what people are failing to understand. It wasn't, it says it's there to rehabilitate, but that's not what it does. And so it was designed to, like a wheelhouse where people go in and they leave and they go and they come back and they leave and they go and they come back. That's what our criminal justice system was designed to do. There's a lot of talk right now around probation and parole. If that changes, then that would bring a whole change to our criminal justice system, and I think that's why the focus is around probation and parole, because most of the people that's on probation and parole make up our criminal justice system. They'll get 10 years on probation or parole, but then they'll do 3 years in prison. So that's 3 years of labor we get out of them, then they're back out. Then they might get a violation. So then we get another year of labor out of them, then they're back out. Then we might get another year of labor out of them, and then depending on what charge they got, we might be able to tack on another 3 years of probation. So then if they get in trouble again, we get another 2 years out. I mean, it's just a cycle of, it's a very vicious cycle. So the talk right now is around probation, especially in Philadelphia. They actually have a smart probation bill where you'll get out, you'll be on probation for 1 year. Well, no, you get an annual after 1 year. So 1 year, you're out. If you're doing good, you get off probation. If you're not doing good or you're having hiccups, they're gonna increase your supportive services. So like they're doing like wraparound services. So like they want to make sure you're working a job. They want to make sure you're getting back and forth to your treatment programs if that's what need be. They want to make sure you got transportation. So it's called smart probation. It's a really good model that I think that could really work for individuals. Because if you don't keep an individual or if you don't keep a person under scrutiny for, 3-4 years, you're gonna find something wrong. Like they're gonna do something wrong. Like I'm looking for you to do something wrong. But get empowering individuals to actually get out and change their lives, that's gonna be the difference. And I think that's what the talk is right now around the country. Those individuals who are being released, how do we keep them from going back? Not necessarily getting people out, but how do we keep the individuals who are getting released from going back?
So I was on the prison ministry board, and when we go into the prison, so we would work with being in the prison and then as the transitional housing after. And it was an economic issue. People who cannot afford to live because they can't get a job because they have a felony, or they have no money to put a down payment on their apartment, or they can't provide for their family, tend to commit crimes, or have free time in which they do things that they maybe shouldn't do also. And we don't have enough support to provide them with more opportunities to get a better job, to educate a job, to find housing, to find a support system, to find a way to get to work and to make that accountable. I think that it's at the end of the day, for everyone, it's an economic issue.
It very well is. A lot of the, we hold community conversations right now at a Newton Correctional Facility. And I just learned so much from those guys, because there's a lot of really bright individuals. Those guys have a lot of great ideas.
those guys have done a lot of great things in their lives. They've made mistakes, and they're paying their price for the mistake that they made, or they're paying the price for the decision that they made. They've made decisions, and they're paying for those decisions. But coming back to an economical standpoint, when asking those guys, like, man, what's the number one thing, like, if, you know, like, when you got out last time, like, what was the change? Like, what made you go back? Like, what made you turn back? It's like, man, like, I couldn't afford to pay the bills. I couldn't afford to pay the rent. I couldn't afford to put gas in the car. I couldn't afford this. I couldn't afford that. So, again, it always ends up going back to an economical standpoint. So, I guess when you're talking about, like, how do we get people who are in those situations to not go back, or who are coming from prison to not go back to prison, maybe give them an opportunity to earn a decent wage, a living wage, you know, that they can actually take care of themselves and their families.
To that point, there was something that was introduced this year, and I don't know where it's at currently, but basically it would allow you as an employer, you were not allowed to ask the question on the application if you were convicted of a felony. You could still ask in the interview that question, and I think the mentality is if I at least get you to the interview stage, and you come in and you don't, that person sees you differently, sees you as an individual, they're not the stereotypical criminal that they thought they were, or whatever envisioned, at least you get them to the interview stage. A lot of people could see their way of hiring people that might have a conviction. Do you know if that's still alive, or if that's something that's been...
So at the state level, it's actually not introduced at the state level, but Greater Des Moines, so like Des Moines and all of the surrounding counties, except for, alright, so I don't know the name of the county, but I know it's Indianola. So what's the name of that county?
Warren
County. Alright, thank you. So except for Warren County, all of the other counties in the Greater Des Moines Partnership have agreed to remove that from their applications. So that, I mean, that, so think about, no one's perfect. I don't know what everyone's did, but just think about an individual. The only difference, like I always tell people like that are not in my shoes, the only difference between me and you is a decision. I made a decision to go down the path that I went down. You made the decision to go down the path that you're down or that you're on right now. And so I always talk, like I was really great friends with Judge Colin Witt, the late Judge Colin Witt, who just passed in Des Moines. But we used to always talk about some of the trouble that he never got into. The trouble that he never got in. And this was a judge. And so when talking about that, the only difference between us or people with criminal convictions and people without criminal convictions are whether you got caught or not. That's the difference. It's not, there's no difference in the human being, like it's some DNA or something that's like, oh, that person has the DNA, they're going to be a criminal, but that person, they're going to be a good lawyer. No, I got caught, you didn't get caught. I was in a situation where it was easy for me to get caught because my neighborhood, you see how my neighborhood set up, the cops ride around all the time. Well, in your neighborhood, the cops barely pass through. They might not even drive through your neighborhood. So it's a little different there. So
I drove without a license.
It'll cost you, man.
Yeah. So. No, not me. I never got pulled over.
Lord, are you serious? Oh my God, that's crazy. But yeah, that's the only difference. So giving people the opportunity to sit down and have that conversation, so you can understand. Oh, hey. You know, this person's admitting that they made a decision, or if they want to call it a mistake, I call them decisions, because you made the decision. This person's admitting that they made a decision, they learned from their decision, and they're looking to move forward now. And all they need is an opportunity on that path. Well, hey, let's give them an opportunity. Why not? Because most times, what a lot of employers are saying right now across the country, the people that they're hiring that are coming out, that are returning citizens, they're producing a little more than their regular employees. Why is that? Well, and this is just me thinking personally, because it is personal. if I've never had an opportunity, and now I get an opportunity to make some money, I don't got to look over my shoulder. I don't got to worry about the police coming to kick down my door because I got some bud or some guns or some whatever in my place. And I actually get to live? Oh, well, I'm going to go full-fledged on this thing. And if I get an opportunity to show that I can produce more, you better believe I'm producing more. Nobody's going to outwork me. Nobody. Nobody's going to outthink me. Nobody's going to outwork me. Why? Because I never got an opportunity to do something like this. So when I get this opportunity, ain't nobody taking it from me. And so we're finding that people who didn't previously have opportunities, when they get an opportunity, they're probably going to produce a little bit more than your regular person who's maybe feeling obligated or privileged to be where they're at. But again, when you get an opportunity that you haven't had before, you approach it a little differently. So I would say, given those individuals who didn't previously have opportunities, the opportunity to sit down and speak, to speak on their experience, to speak on what they've learned since they've been either incarcerated or on probation or in trouble, whether they went to jail or not. But what did you learn, you know, and how are you looking to move forward? I think that's the biggest thing. That's how we give people an opportunity, and that's how we find out if people want to move forward. What do you want to do?
I want to switch gears on you. I want to talk about the ICE thing. So how does that work? Bear with me. I know just enough to know I don't know, okay? How does that work if there's like a family that, say, both the parents might be here illegally, they think, but the children are citizens? What's the protocol there? If they take the parents, do the citizens get moved too, or what's the plan with these children? How does that all work? Because I think that's happening more than people realize.
Yes, and that's why there's a lot more conversation around it now, and that's why you're finding at the borders there's gates and tents and busloads of children just sitting in these facilities because both of their parents were not here with the proper paperwork that they needed to have, and so now their children have been taken, and now they're victims of this system as well. There is no proper protocol right now, and that's why there's conversation being had, because they're saying these kids shouldn't be sitting in detention for 2 to 3 weeks without contact from their parents, without, like, something has to give. So they're actually trying to create some sort of legislation and some sort of public policy around this issue, but there's not right now.
Well, because I'm thinking of somebody that asked about as educators, how does it influence? Well, I know, like, for me once, I was working with a family that the mom and dad were removed from the home, and so then the daughter was able to stay with her aunt so she could keep going to school because she was a citizen. But then some of our school personnel were like, well, her aunt can't sign for her because she's not technically her parent, and we never got legal documentation that she's the guardian. So that's where I feel like us as educators were impacted, because who is this 15-year-old's guardian? Mm-hmm. Her parents have now been removed, and she's a citizen, and she deserves a right to an education.
Most times when that happens, when both parents are removed, DHS gets involved right away. And DHS is usually the guardian because DHS is the one placing her at aunt's house. So in Iowa, most cases, that's what happened. ICE removes, DHS comes in, they get involved, they look for a person who's has the proper paperwork or is legal to be here, and they try to make sure it's a person that's close to the family, that the kids know, that the kids can understand, and that the kids feel safe with, and they try to place the youth with those individuals.
So in that case, DHS should have told us the aunt
yes,
had rights
yes,
to sign papers.
Yes.
And
and if you look on the news, you'll see there's a lot of issues with DHS right now.
Yeah.
That I can't even.
Yeah.
Yes. I think we have room for maybe 2 or 3 more questions.
This is more of a comment than a question, but just thinking and kind of putting together some of the conversation here, it seems to me like maybe at some point somebody in the right position should suggest that groups like Iowa Prison Industries, in order to be able to contract with prisons, should then offer jobs to those that have already been doing it for 50 cents an hour. Once they get out and pay them $15 an hour, they're still going to make $3 an hour on the job. So if you want this contract, once they're done building this, and you pay them a living wage once they get out.
I asked that question the first day. Is when I said, do the people get to work it when they leave? That's a very great question. I think people should do that. I think so. I think any of the industries that those individuals work in, you know, people, there's a couple girls that work over at the governor's office. There's a couple girls that work at the front desk out at the prison at Mitchellville. Why can't they work? If they're able to work it now, why can't they work it? What's the difference? Because I live here? Okay, I don't live here no more. Still pay me, and I'll come back here to work. And it's an opportunity for me to keep doing something constructive and stay out of trouble, and I won't come back here. But yes, I think that's a really great question. Yeah, but cheap labor is a lot cheaper than paying. One more question. Comment, concern, something. Come on. Wake up.
I was just thinking about how you described your experience in moving to Iowa and talking about being in a small, predominantly white, rural Iowa community. We have a really similar demographic here. Any kind of thoughts on community approaches or like approaches by colleges or K-12s or businesses about, best practices and inclusivity and thinking about racial justice and being honest about some injustices that happen?
I mean, I don't necessarily know how big your population is out here, but I mean, and obviously I can't just tell you, like, hey, hire everybody that's coming here, you know, open up the doors to them, but just, you know, being open-minded. I think that's the number one thing, just being open-minded to change, whether it's someone moving in next door to you. Just being open-minded. That would be the biggest thing that I could say to anyone. Just be open-minded, because you never know what a person has gone through. You never know what a person's experiences are. You never know who a person knows. You know, I found that out in a good way. Found it out good, but you never know who a person knows. So it's always good to have those conversations and figure out who they know or what their experience is, and you know, just make them feel included. You know, like exactly how you would do your cousin or your brother or your sister or anybody else new moving to town. Hey, how you doing? How you feeling? Make a person feel like they're part of this community. That's the biggest thing. So whether that's having a conversation, a cup of coffee, taking a cheeseburger or a slice of cake. I don't know what you guys do in Carroll. No, we actually took our neighbor cheeseburgers. We cooked some burgers and we had new neighbors. I was like, you know something, it's kind of weird, but I'm going to just cook them some burgers. They were just some little slider burgers. So I took them over. They were like, well, thank you guys. We don't have to cook tonight. So it was a good thing. But, yeah, just making people feel included, you know, just, you know, being open-minded to having that conversation and to making that first step, or that first act.
Just a comment?
Yep.
I'm not from here. Most of you can tell that. But I've talked to enough people that were this country simply a work in progress. And so you think, go back 150 years and 100 years and all the things that have changed, and talk about inclusiveness or outsiders. Talk to some of the really older Irish Catholics who moved here, who struggled and struggled because the German Catholics were in control. And so then there was not even a racial barrier or anything else, but it's because you're not familiar, you're different, or maybe you're Protestant. So the other thing is that, and as we evolve, it's going to hopefully on a personal basis, because you can't pass a law that affects behavior. And it has some legal protections in it, but that doesn't really change people's minds or brains.
Mm-hmm.
And myself, it's just like, I'm trying to think of an example coming here, working while I was a retired foot doctor, had a patient here for a year and a half, had nice conversations, and one day he comes in, we're talking, and I can say, like, this is not normal, something's changed. And I said, is there something wrong? He says, can I ask you a question? And I said, sure. And he said, are you black? And I'm going, yes, but why do you ask? Because his only experience living here and not traveling outside was seeing blacks on TV from Omaha, Sioux City, and Des Moines, and most of them were either felons or athletes, and their English wasn't like mine. So maybe because my English was typically like everybody else in Carroll County, maybe that I wasn't black. And up until then, I had never thought that because I talk the way I do, then some people think, well, maybe I'm not black. Like, really? So we find out things slowly but surely over the years. So we find it hard to cut slack for people we don't know, we don't understand, and they're new.
Or do we view as the other?
Yeah, and so that's standard no matter where you go. And we think that this is maybe a unique problem here or in Iowa or in the United States, but if you go anywhere in the world, you know, people who are not from there, look first, like, who are you? Why are you here? And then maybe after a while we break down some of those barriers. But it always ultimately ends up with a personal-to-personal relationship and talking to people and finding out who you are. And it took me a while. I'm not, people would say I've changed, I guess. Then when I came here, I wasn't so quick to just want to talk to people. Because I'm thinking, oh, what are they thinking about me? What's going on? Why this and why that? And then later on I realized, I don't care. And I talk to people, and if I get along with them, I do, and I talk to other people, I don't, and find out, ultimately, it really wasn't racial, it wasn't anything. It's just, who are you as a person? But again, unless you start getting out and having the contact, most of those things don't happen, which is really kind of sad.
Which goes right hand in hand with your keep an open mind. Mm-hmm. You know, because information and getting to know people is key to understanding their behavior, their expectations, their culture. I mean, it's key.
And there are people who have been here for generations who are German Catholic who don't get along with some of the other German Catholics. Typical, that's life.
On a closing note, I went to Chicago about two, three weeks ago. I went up and visited some of my cousins. And so my mom always shares, like, pictures on Facebook of me, whether I'm, like, at a, you know, hosting an event. I have a consultation company as well that I run as well. So she's always, like, sharing some pictures and stuff like that. And coming back to talking about being open-minded, well, my cousin was like, they always give me stuff about the people that I rub elbows with, you know, about where I live in Grimes, Iowa. You know, my family came out for my wedding and stuff, and, like, they know. Like, I'm, like, the only black person that lives on my entire block, you know. And so they always give me stuff about, you know, who I rub elbows with. But I was explaining to my cousin, I'm like, you got to be open-minded. Like, it was a blessing for me to be able to come from where I come from and to live where I live now. It's a blessing for me to be able to do what I'm doing now and to come from where we come from, where you're still at. And I was like, it's that open-mindedness that got me out of here. Had I not started having conversations with people that I felt uncomfortable around, you know, I wouldn't be where I am right now. So I think, and this is what I was telling them, I was like, I think you should learn a thing or two from me, man, and start having conversations with people that you're uncomfortable with. Because basically our conversation was, he didn't feel comfortable having conversations with white people. I say, well, most of the jobs in your community are owned by white people. So how are you going to go get a job? Like, how are you going to get a job? What are you going to, so if you don't get a job and you plan on going to the bank to go get a loan, who are you going to talk to? So why are you sitting here trying to be Mr. Tough Guy, trying to talk, let's be logical here. Let's be smart here. You need to open your mind up and have a conversation. So just be open-minded. Thank you all today.
Thank you.